When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Meet the Founder, a new series within But Why Podcast. My name is Clemmie Telford, and before I began out on social media, my career was in advertising as an agency creative director and later as a creative strategist at Facebook and Instagram. I have a fascination with brands, how and why they exist, and the stories of the people behind them. Meet the Founder is my opportunity to marry my love of honest conversations about tricky subjects with my curiosity about brands. It's business chat, but a bit nosier.
I had a phenomenal start to my career. So then by the time I was 30, I set myself a goal to have had 3 editorships, which was all about, I mean, it's a bit of a nightmare in its own right, isn't it? Where's the loyalty here, Lisa?
Like, she's
stick
off
with us, yeah.
Today, I'm talking to Lisa Smorsarski. You give it to me?
Smorsarski.
Someone with a lisp and dyslexic is like...
I'm just here to challenge you, yeah.
Who is editor-in-chief of Stylist magazine. So she's not so much a founder, but you were founding editor, which I find just as fascinating.
That is correct, I was.
So give me the elevator pitch for the mag, why it exists, what it exists for.
So when we launched Stylist, we wanted to do magazines differently for women, and really in the simplest elevator form, it was treating women intelligently through their magazine. We launched as a feminist title. That was particularly new, I think, actually, when we launched 13 years ago. And we just wanted to be an advocate, a cheerleader for women, and to change the conversation about how media treated women as well.
I'm trying to do the maths in my head and also try and work out what time we're talking about. What was the tone at that point?
So it's 2009 was when we launched. It was a big tail end of celeb culture. So lots of weeklies, lots of circles of shame, lots of kind of women feeling bad about themselves. So I was sort of enjoying the titillation. It was quite a complex relationship with magazines, I think. I had come from More magazine when I launched Stylist, and, you know, we were sort of dabbling in that space, but all the research was suggesting that women wanted something different. And, you know, I could testify to that. I was looking for that as well, which I think is often the case when you're launching new businesses. You're trying to fill a need that you have, particularly as women. So we were very different. The tone was very different. It was slightly before Instagram launched, slightly before Catlin Moran's books came out and sort of changed some of the conversation around feminism. So we were sort of on the cusp. And I mean, I remember going out to ad agencies, you'll remember this from your background, and going, we're going to be this feminist title. And people like, I'm going to stop you there. You know, like, because it was just seen as this kind of, well, terrifying idea. Why would you be a feminist magazine? And I was like, well, we're a magazine for women who want equality. Why wouldn't we be that? So I think, you know, we were trying to set a bit of a different tone with Stylist.
Yeah, it's so strange because now it's really obvious. Of course, that's how we should talk. Of course, you can be a feminist and be into fashion and be into style and be into all of. But yeah, again, picturing that time, it was off the back of that celebrity bit. It's a strange era because I felt like I was quite empowered at the time. But then you look back at some of the behaviour, quite a lot of sexism, quite a lot of trying to keep up with the lads. And that was my experience of agency culture at the time.
Yeah, I think that's really familiar to me as well. And I think probably, look, it was called ladette culture, wasn't it? So it was trying to be one of the boys. And that did give a sense of agency and empowerment. You weren't bound by traditional kind of stereotypes, what it meant to be a woman or the type of content you'd enjoy as a woman. But it did have its downsides because, again, it wasn't recognising perhaps you might have differences in how you want to approach the world. I mean, it's remarkable, actually, if you think 13 years on, we work in a culture which talks about kindness and kind of traditional feminine stereotypes in business. But we were rejecting those back then. You know, we were trying to play with the boys. And I think that has been one of the most phenomenal shifts, I think, in how people talk about business, particularly.
It's so true. You definitely, I bought into the idea that you had to be a bit of a ball breaker to, you know, it was so far away from the 80s. But yeah, you definitely had to keep up with the banter if you wanted to succeed.
Yeah. And I think we, you know, those of us of that generation have that slightly hardened exterior a lot of the time, because that was basically, you were going to have to suck it up a bit to, in order to have your place at the table. So you weren't going to be 50-50 men and women. That wasn't going to happen. You were going to have to break through. You were going to have to be a pioneer. And actually, you would probably have to just slot into how business was being done. And I think it's actually through the agency of women bringing in new ways of thinking. And I, you know, I say men can be empathetic and kind. Of course they can. Women can be, can't think of a better word than ballsy. It's a terrible word, but, you know, can actually be super tough. Men and women can do all of these things, but actually it's the combination of all those gears that sees productivity results.
Yeah, so true. And it's mad to be at the, we're at similar points in our career where you can begin to reflect. And before we turned on the record, we were talking about that era and our first days in working. And we're recording this in central London, and it always instills that vibe in me when anything felt possible. Do you remember that time?
Yeah. Oh my God. We started our careers. I started my career in 1998, and I just graduated. I got this amazing job as junior writer on Bliss magazine. I thought the world was mine. It really felt like it was mine for the taking. You know, I was working in a very high-flying industry. There was lots of money around, lots of that being spent on entertaining people, hospitality, very different era to what we sit in now for a lot of people. And I was just going for it. I was like, this will be mine. I will take all the opportunities that come away. It felt good. It felt buoyant.
But it's interesting because now I look back and I'm like, what is it that I thought I was taking? Like, what, is it that I wanted? And yeah, I mean, look, you're editor-in-chief. This would have been the thing that you got there. Is it strange to sit with that idea that you got to the thing that you wanted?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea. I think all of my goals and ambitions were based on something that I achieved by the age of 30 and then was like, all right, what's next? And I think we spend so much time thinking about that first chapter of our careers when actually we want to think about the second, third, fourth, you know, so many people pivoting, so many people reinventing. The world of work has changed so much. So I do... Often I think about the goals that I set myself, and it was about, you know, I was editor of Smash Hits at 25. So I had a phenomenal start to my career. So then by the time I was 30, I set myself a goal to have 3 editorships, which was all about, I mean, it's a bit of a nightmare in its own right, isn't it? Where's the loyalty here, Lisa?
Like, she's
stick
off
with us. Yeah. And then I went to stylist and thought, this is my place. You know, I've created this amazing thing. I want to stick with it. And that brings a whole kind of, I've learned a lot through that process and expanding a business, growing a business, not, you know, the ups and downs that business can bring as well. So I do reflect, isn't it mad that I set out to do something and I do it? But then I think, right, what's next? You know, I'm sort of I guess it's human nature. We're kind of goal-driven people, aren't we? Humans are goal-driven. So I find that interesting. And I think reflecting as well, I am learning from younger generations definitely now about how you don't have to fulfill everything through work and work alone, which I think is something our generation do struggle with. We put everything into work. And I actually don't think that's necessarily the case for those that are coming behind us. So we're probably the mad ones who... worked around the clock, did all these things that we were told we needed to do to succeed. We saw results. It's kind of validation. So we kept doing it. But actually, there is a different way to be and to work.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And like, it's very strange when you do achieve your goals. And for me, as a perpetual person who's obsessed with goals, more often than not, I'm quite disappointed when I get there, which is not surprising because... you just get there. And I always laugh, you know, all my big promotions have happened in amongst other big moments in your life, you know, sometimes quite rubbish moments, sometimes when you're not feeling your best. And it's never that, oh, champagne and fireworks and now I feel fantastic. It's always like, oh yeah, but I've suddenly got a whole lot more responsibility or there's other things going on.
Yeah, isn't it funny, isn't it? It doesn't quite feel like you think it's going to feel sometimes.
Never.
But yeah, I guess that's it. We're sort of in an, I think we're in a new world of work where actually we're redefining what satisfaction, success looks and feels like. And is that about fulfillment? Is that about purpose? Will you achieve that all through work? Full stop. Probably not. We learn that, I think, as we get older. So I think there's probably, we're about to go through this seismic shift on how we think about goals and what we achieve. And I definitely think, you know, for me and women, I'll say specifically of my generation, I do think there is a shift in like, actually, we've got to reset how we think about work particularly.
Yeah.
But what it means to our identity and
yeah, that's
happiness.
That's really fascinating, isn't it? Like if you have a career and it's one you're proud of and it feels like quite a big career, but then who you are outside of that. And for me, the big thing came when I had kids and you're suddenly introduced as their parent. Mm. And you're like, oh, but what, you know, 2 weeks ago I was in the office and I was doing this. Yeah. And then suddenly, like, this is a reality check.
I can relate to that, yeah. So-and-so's mum. Oh, what? So it starts in the hospital appointments, doesn't it? You're like, I'm a human with achievements and like an identity of my own. But yeah, that's it. We are lots of different things. And actually just hanging all of our hopes and dreams on one element is quite dangerous, I suspect. You know, it's very... We're asking a hell of a lot of something that's set up to make the world work and a financial capitalist structure in terms of trying to get our identity and happiness from it as well.
I'm proud to be career driven and it's brought me so much joy and satisfaction, but it can be an uncomfortable question to ask yourself at this point.
Mm.
Who am I outside of that?
Yeah. I don't. And it's a game I like to play and I'm quite scared of the answers, I'll be honest. I definitely haven't nailed it.
One thing I was interested in, though, you talked about this idea of longevity. And actually, during the conversations I've been having for this podcast, I think sometimes in the way we think about business now and because of Instagram and things blowing up, we don't hear about the long game. Mm. But yeah, you've been at Stylist for a long time. Did you expect it to be a long-term plan and how has it ended up being that way?
I absolutely didn't expect to be at Stylist for 13 years. I think probably because I hadn't done that before. So although I'd worked for one company before with a slight blip in the middle, it wasn't a bad blip. That sounds like I was fired. I wasn't. I left for a bit and came back. I'd moved around a lot of different brands and I'd, you know, for me, I was just gaining experience, seeing the world, working with different people. I couldn't imagine at that point when I walked into Stylist that I would be there 13 years later because that hadn't been my experience. I think two things happened. One, I sort of fell in love with it and just thought, I've created this phenomenal thing. It's I'm very emotionally connected, which is quite unusual, I think, for lots of people in work. And secondly, I was afforded a lot of brilliant opportunities there. So I came in as founding editor, you know, created and launched this product with my brilliant team. It was just the magazine. Then we expanded into digital. Then we expanded into events, you know, social, video, email. So every year I sort of felt like I was learning something and taking that into my skill set. And then I joined the board of directors. So I had the kind of business side of it as well. So it has felt like this kind of constantly fluid experience. I don't feel like it's been static. And I think I've learned so much. I know I've changed a lot in terms of how I might tackle things as a manager or a leader. And, you know, I really feel more comfortable and confident now because of that experience that I've been afforded. So, you know, it's been the most amazing learning experience as well, which I think I think that is the thing I'm probably most grateful for, is being able to learn and work in an area that I'm really passionate about and emotionally connected to. It's a phenomenal brand. We've created this amazing thing. So I feel like I'm probably spoiled by that as well.
Well, that's a lovely place to be because it's so easy to fall out of love with your work, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's it. You know, it's not always easy, is it? You know, work is set to challenges as a manager and leader. You know, you might have day-to-day challenges. As a business leader, obviously, you're looking at macro and microeconomics. That can be challenging at times. You know, like everyone, I'll have days where I'm like, good God, this is hard. This is a hard day or a hard week. But ultimately, when you believe in the mission of what you're doing, which I do, I feel, and having had that journey of launching something and seeing where we've been able to take it, I think is a pretty special opportunity, actually. And yeah, so I feel very privileged and very lucky to have been on that journey.
And has your audience grown up with you, or have you got new audience along the way? Has the demographic shifted?
We have managed to recruit, and that's particularly come in like new readers over those 13 years. That's because we're using different platforms. We have slightly different age groups on different platforms. So obviously how you discover stylists will be different for different people. The founding readers, I guess those of 13 years ago who were very much based on the print product, still come to our events. I met someone last week. We were doing this event called Stylist Network, which is a business, and it was particularly focused on entrepreneurs event. And someone came up to me and she went, "I came to your first ever event," and which must be close to 12, 13 years ago. And she's like, "I've loved stylists ever since, really loyal." And then I'll meet younger women who've just discovered stylists for the first time. So we're managing to have, we still speak to the same woman. We always said we didn't want to define her by a life stage necessarily. We wanted someone to be shared by this kind of ethos, way of looking at the world.
I love that. It's, as we're talking, it is exactly that, the picking it up in the beginning of our careers. But I guess because you were very much values led rather than life stage, that means it does translate, and it will translate in different ways depending on your life stage. But I'm thinking, I was part of that campaign you did where you showed load of us with it, naked with our backs, and that but like body image, confronting body image challenges is universal, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, exactly. And actually if that was last summer, and if you look at that cover and the women that got involved, and it's probably just to explain, we asked our audience, do you want to come along to a shoot? Obviously we asked some of our friends of our brands to come and get involved, and we had just the most phenomenal spectrum of women there, which is the thing that makes me the happiest, to be honest, that we are able to have a conversation with so many different women, but we are united in the same ways, and we learn from each other's experience, we can share that. And I think, you know, that particular cover was looking at the challenges we have around diet culture and body image, and it's a topic we've been really cautious about touching, actually, because we were very anti-diet when we launched, because we'd launched into this newsstand, I guess, where it was all about, it was so obsessed with body image. Diets were on every single cover as a cover line. I hated it. I hated what that was doing to women. I hated the fact it was a lie, selling these ridiculous dreams about lose X amount of pounds in 4 weeks and non-sustainable ways to think healthily about your body, but really the damage to body image. So I rejected it totally. I was like, we won't do this to you. We won't force feed. We'll not talk about homogenized ideals. But still, 13 years later, women are still having the same issues and challenges. So we don't want to ignore that either. So trying to have these conversations, but seeing how cross-generational, every single kind of divide that you could put amongst women, the issues were the same. So I think that's what Stylist has been able to do, is to bring women together. We find at our big events, so we do this brilliant event every November called Stylist Live, and it is the loveliest group of women you could ask for, who come together. Lots come on their own. We have a catwalk, and often you'll find women who've just met sat on the benches of this catwalk, just coming together, and like, they're not people you would piece together in normal life, but really getting something about that shared space. So that's something I probably feel the proudest about, is that ability to have these connecting conversations.
Yeah, and it must be for you as well, I don't know if a lot of it is your own journey with any of these things. You know, when you talk about body image, it's if you've been brought up, as we've said, in that culture of circle of shame and how much people weigh, it's like, because a couple of your staff were also photographed in that shoot, and I remember waiting to go on with them, and you know, they're feeling exactly the same as everyone else, and that's what's an amazing thing, where it kind of works through the staff into your audience.
I mean, that particular idea was a colleague of mine who is particularly affected by the feelings around body image and diet culture and what that had done to her. And that sparked a conversation where the team all started to relate and share stories. I feel like my experience was a bit different, but outside looking in, going, God, I've been part of the machine in the past that sort of did these things, and how uncomfortable, how could I change that conversation? Because, you know, anyone who worked on women's magazines back in the 90s and noughties were really was probably part of that culture. There was very, there were no titles not doing that. For me, that was a period of reflection to go, I don't like this. I'm not comfortable with this. It doesn't speak to me on any level, let alone think about what the damaging implications of that can be.
We touched on something then. I'm interested to know, as you go up the ranks, you obviously go into management role and then you're managing a team. What's your management style like? What have you learned about yourself in that?
I feel like I've changed. That's the bit I feel like I've changed and learned the most in. I mean, I mentioned earlier I was editor of Smash Hits at 25, and with that comes a team, and I did not know what I was doing. Like, I mean, I realise how little now if I could look back on it. I did my best. I tried to manage instinctively based on how I liked to be managed, but there's not much sophistication perhaps in doing it like that. So I think particularly over the last, I don't know, decade really, I feel like I've learned a lot in this space. And I've always, you know, genuinely have kindness as an ethos, even in the most challenging periods. Even if you've got to have your toughest chat ever, you can be kind about it. And I think that's always been really important to me. I hope it has, and I hope no one will listen to this and say to the contrary, because I kind of think they're the times when actually how we lead really counts. They're in the tough times. It's easy to be chipper and motivational when everything is going great, but how do you deal with the difficult bits? I've learned so much more about how to listen, actually, to take on board other people's experiences, to try and see things from other people's perspective, to canvas opinion, but also to be decisive and to move on. You know, you can canvas opinion to death, you know, but there's a fine line, but, you know, involving people in the right ways. So I think for me, I would hope I am collaborative, I am kind, but to be a leader, you have to lead as well. And that is about decision making. It's about having a vision and taking people on that journey with you. And, you know, making sure. Well, one thing I love about Silas is we have this phenomenal shared vision. And I think, you know, there's not a member of that team who doesn't know what it is and what we stand for. And that's about the clarity of the DNA of the business, about what we want to achieve beyond publishing. You know, what do we want to stand for and represent? And I think for me, that they're the biggest learnings, is how you get people to that point and, you know, be a decent human in the process.
Yeah, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because that canvassing idea is really interesting, because you do need to read the room and read the energy, but you also, you've got the buck to stop with you for part of it. And you,
I mean, look, you know, part of being an editor particularly is making unpopular decisions. Somebody will always be annoyed with you, because if you've got five people pitching you ideas, you're going to have to pick one. You're going to have to stand by it, and you're going to have to move on. And I've often said to my more junior editors, you know, just make a decision. Mm. People are looking at you for a decision. They need leadership, and they want to know the direction of travel, and want to believe in what you want to achieve. But do that with the knowledge that you need to make that decision. Get enough information, not too much. You know, it's sort of, but there is a point where you do have to call it. And so for me, learning very early on, actually, how to make what might be an unpopular decision, because, you know, people have different ideas and different ways of thinking, in a fair way, and being comfortable with that, not going to bed at night going, oh God, did I handle that properly? That they are big things that you can only really get through experience, I think, of having the opportunity to make those calls. So I always tell people, if I'm mentoring them, like, challenge yourself. What would be your decision in that situation? How would you stand by it? Even if you're not the person making that decision, how would you do it? Because it's a skill and a discipline, actually, to be able to do it and stand by it.
Yeah, that's there's actually nothing more damaging in business as someone picking, or anything, to be honest. I'm saying this because I'm doing this house renovation and, you know, decisions that I'm now unpicking. You know, actually, you've got to have the confidence of your convictions sometimes, haven't you?
And so you do, and sometimes you have to be wrong.
Yeah.
And that has to be all right as well. You know, you have to, hopefully you work in enough of a safe space where you can make a call and you will accept that, you know, hopefully it's not so catastrophic, but sometimes you might go, I would do that differently next time. What can I learn from that? How can I move that on? Because I think that's it, you know, in a high-paced decision-making environment like editing is, and, you know, we've got daily products, weekly, monthly, you are making decisions all the time. And I think some of them, not all of those, are going to be brilliant, right? Sometimes you will have messed up, or you might have made slightly the wrong call, and actually how you deal with that and how you move on are really important. I think this is my point about listening, is I think you can learn all the time. You can sort of go, right, how would I handle that differently? What's the different perspective that I'm being positioned with? How do I take that on board? And be prepared to say, you're right, I'm wrong. That is quite a skill as well.
You talked about mentoring then. Have you had a mentor yourself during this process?
I've never had a formal mentor relationship, but I have had lots of people who I would go to in certain situations. So I feel really lucky. And they've been different people at different points in my career who've just either given me great advice in certain challenging situations. Definitely not done it alone. I've definitely done it with a lot of support and brilliant advice and counsel. I think it's important. You know, I think if you can have a traditional kind of set up, established mentor relationship, I would recommend that. I think one of my big things is no one knows it all on their own. Really don't. Like, I think that for ideas creatively with stylists, I'm like, our idea would be better with more than one brain on this. So how can you grow on each other's idea? And it is how I prefer to work. So I think, again, the mentor relationships can be really valuable because you won't know everything, and that's all right.
How does Cascade coming up in journalism, do you tend to have an editor and a junior relationship? Do you have that kind of, do you work into people that end up shaping how you do your job?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, particularly for me, I came into journalism and I didn't know anyone who was a journalist. I just sort of plucked it out the air as something that would be really exciting to do. And wouldn't that be amazing? And were then really amazed that people had these networks already existing. And I was like, oh God, like I know no one or how this all works. And I was just so keen to succeed. And I think if you're lucky enough to get a good editor, and that could be, as a journalist, that might be your department editor, a features editor, a commissioning editor, or it might be your editor-in-chief. So there's tiers of people who that might be. But actually someone is giving you advice and structure how to write in a different way or how to manage an interview. It's a huge growth period, I think, particularly when you come into the industry. So you are made and sculpted by the good and the bad around you. You learn what you don't want to be as well.
Yeah, that's really true. And all those cliches about being nice to people on the way up.
Oh, God, that is really true. Yeah. There's some people now, I'm like, they do what? You know, it's like, it's incredible. But, you know, you particularly, you'll relate with the same generation, but people who were your junior who are now running these like incredible businesses. It's phenomenal. But I think that's just about being a decent human, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, these aren't business things, are they?
No.
Life. Tell me about a mistake then along the way, or if there's anything in particular moments you would do differently.
The one that springs to mind is, and there are plenty, don't get me wrong, there are plenty. I got the editorship of Bliss, which was a teen magazine. I'd worked there as a junior writer and a features editor. So I had this sort of long-standing relationship. And I got this gig as editor and I just felt like I had to make my mark really quickly. And I think it's a huge pressure that lots of editors particularly put themselves under, which is, what's my vision? How am I going to prove that to everyone? And my first issue, I just ripped out this entire section because I didn't like it personally. And really proud of myself. Yeah, guys, we're not doing that anymore. And I didn't tell anyone about this. So an editor reports into a publisher traditionally who very tactfully came in the day the magazine came into the offices going, seems to be an entire section missing from this, Lisa. And I was like, yeah, I didn't like it. So I thought it'd be better, explain my rationale. And she was like, actually, did you look at the reader research? And I was like, no, I didn't. And again, it had tested really well historically. Now, it didn't have an impact in terms of sales or the longevity, but it was a really big learning curve for me because she did handle it well because she challenged me to think about it as opposed to telling me off, which is basically what she was there to do. But I think what I did, and I definitely did it a couple of times, was desperately tried to prove myself by making huge changes. And actually, that's not necessarily what was being asked. Mm-hmm. It was calm, thoughtful, considered leadership. And so often I think people, in any business, people go, I must rip things up and do it differently because it's not my way. And that's not always the best way. So I think for me, I've definitely done it a couple of times and I've definitely advised people not to do it a lot more times than that afterwards.
And then actually it's interesting because in that era, you didn't have such real-time audience feedback. Because imagine now if you put a mag out with a whole section gone, it went live. Oh, I mean, how quickly the acid test.
Yeah, I mean, I feel grateful I didn't grow up making those mistakes in a world of social media, actually. Yeah. It makes it much harder. And I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for social media. I think it does incredible things in uniting people, in advocating, giving agency. And I think it's phenomenally dangerous in other ways. And I think in my industry, one of the challenges is that fear of cancel culture has stopped people taking risks or being brave. And I think, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily have done that for the right reason, but it would have given you the fear of making any change or kind of disrupting anything, because we listen to the loudest voices, not necessarily the most important voices.
In fact, it's deeply worrying if journalism edits itself totally.
Because yeah, exactly. What you do can't we have, afford to do that, you know.
Yeah, we've seen comedians saying that they feel cancelled. It's like we need some people to push.
Look, Gary Lineker is the perfect example as we sit here this week. You know, it's like, you know, the fear of being silenced all the time. Mm. And, you know, that's the BBC acting in a scared way as much as, you know, Gary Lineker fighting back. It's like, you know, these are really important things to pay attention to about what the impact of social media is on how we behave and what we ask of people and what we're brave enough to put out on our platforms. Mm. So I think it's a challenging period of time. And I'm sure if I look back through my career and think where we were brave, would that have changed in the world of social media? Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because of the speed, the thing that I just referenced, because people don't process things, do they? They just react. What does give me hope is that publishing has done really well. You know, books are doing really well, but there is still a place for long form. Do you still find engagement on your longer format?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's sort of we think of ourselves as thoughtful journalists. Mm. So we're trying to have thoughtful takes on the topics that are most meaningful to you. And we talk a lot about the emotional zeitgeist. We're trying to tap into how people are thinking and feeling and behaving. But actually, you do need to do that in a considered way. You can't have, you know, 300 words sort of summing it all up and it can't just be bashed out quickly. You know, we have to take our time and really dive into all the different angles to balance it where we can. And that is our most popular content still, is that real analysis of thought, really. And which I'm delighted about, because that's really at the heart of what we're trying to achieve is, yes, we're obviously going to have lots of different content in lots of different ways, but really getting into this nitty gritty, analyzing thoughtfulness. I think it's still really critical. And people vote with their clicks, right? Mm. So it's really nice to see that content still really resonates.
I've just thought of yesterday, I was introduced to this AI copywriting. Have you been exposed to some of this?
Yeah.
And I was like, this is going to be terrible. And then the person put in like a broad thing. She actually put in like motherhood and sex as the topic and the word count. And I was like, this is going to... And
it's not bad, is it?
It's not bad. Like, there's a sense of humor. You know, she went for a funny one. There's a sense of humor. There's structure. I was like, nah.
Oh God.
But actually, an important thing, it can't replicate humanness that has to come through a human brain, I hope.
I think so. No, I think you're absolutely right on that. Yeah, those bigger nuances. The human experience is complex, as we know. And we're not quite there yet. So I think that's it. It's using what humans do well, what journalists do well, and getting into balance. I mean, one of the things that just fills me with fear, because I remember looking at this before and it was all about algorithms, echo chambers, etc. But, you know, this whole idea that because the majority of data already out there is written by men, we will make those inequalities worse because we're taking a patriarchal gaze basically and exacerbating that. So again, I think it's something you have to rally against as well and find our voice in. Because it's, you know, what exists just isn't balanced enough. And, you know, I'm talking very simply about men and women. If you get into other minority groups, then you're going to have much, much bigger issues. So lots to unpick around there.
And, you know, you can always, you're always fearful of the next bit of technology and the next change. And, you know, we wiggle through it, but it definitely is a fascinating time, isn't it?
Yeah. And look, you know, I guess the natural instinct is to be scared of all tech and change. But I guess how do we use that to our advantage?
Yeah. Couple of questions, a bit more pokey ones. If you were to have founded any other magazine or indeed in the nature of the whole podcast, founded a brand, if you don't want to name check another magazine, what would it have been and why?
I'll go back to magazines, 60s Nova, which was such an incredible pioneer. I was looking at some covers just last week because they were so ahead of their time and I think largely inspired what we did at Stylist. So I love those pioneer brands. I find those absolutely inspiring because, again, it's about being brave. It's what you can do differently, how you can stick your neck out. I think there's some really interesting contemporary brands doing that at the moment. Navara Media, I think, is really interesting in terms of how they've set up their business, but they're trying to challenge a status quo. Extremely left wing, so obviously only for probably a very specific audience, but using social media in a different way. But yeah, probably if I could put my name to it, Nova would have been amazing.
Imagine what it must have been like working at that time.
Well, I found out all the editors were men and it blew my mind. I was looking into it thinking about who actually what brilliant grand dames there might be around to interview and speak to who were from that time, and all the founding editors were men.
Does that disappoint you?
Made me sad. Yeah. I was a bit, because actually the bravery of the covers and speaking to women, I guess it, you know, maybe it had to be like that because it was the only way that magazine would get published. You obviously had Spare Rib around at the same time and other feminist titles, but Nova was like the more mainstream version of that.
There must have been women in the building informing it.
Yes, there were. And actually a lot of those women went on to have great careers as journalists. And who knows what happened? I don't know. This is what I want to know. What happened in the offices? This is what I wanted to dig into. Like, how influential were they? Were the men figureheads or were they really involved in the content? I don't know.
And then another question is, what do you want to achieve this year, broadly this year, or in the near future, either personally or professionally?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for Stylist to keep growing and find new audiences, if I think about professional goals, you know, I think we've done an amazing job at, you know, whether that's through events or through digital verticals and diversifying. So I think for me, I love invention of new things. Like, that is my real buzz. So I'm always thinking about how we can grow, what we can develop, how we can speak to our audience differently. So for me, it would be to sort of add something else to our family. Going back to what we said earlier, this finding some peace and balance with just being and going, actually, my career is great. I'm now off duty and I'm with my kids and my family. You know, I still, like, my eldest child is 12. And I still struggle with the boundaries and how it all works. I've got three kids. So again, it's a peace and balance somehow, trying to find that around work.
Yeah, you must. I'm projecting, but my eldest is 10 and I just suddenly have that real clarity that it's going fast now.
So fast. And and being present. Exactly. Just started secondary. And, you know, I feel the real blessing of... this is a weird thing, but of pandemic and lockdown, I won't say COVID because that's not a blessing, but of that lockdown period was this ability to be at home and be more present, and really has challenged me, I think, in terms of going, right, what does that mean for me? What does my life look and feel like? Because I feel so bloody lucky that I got to have that time to do some pickups and to be present. And yet I'm not. I'm sort of half on my computer and half doing something else. So, yeah, I think this might have been on my to-do list for like the last few years, but it's still there.
I always hope that if it's even on the to-do list, it's kind of
percolating. It's percolating. I think that's a good call, actually, because I think if you're thinking about it, it probably is happening to a degree. It's just, we're very hard on ourselves, aren't we? So I think, just freeing myself up to just enjoy it would be great.
Yeah. But I also think you tapped on something really important, which I don't think is spoken about. If you're seeing women with these high-flying careers, often they aren't at pickup. Like, I think if you see on social media, oh, she's doing it all. No, there's a very clear thing. There's a very clear thing you're not doing, and I'm often not at pickup, and it doesn't sit very easy with me.
Yeah.
But that's the reality.
It's a compromise. I mean, this is it. You know, I wrote a piece a few years ago, which was about not having it all, because, you know, there's that famous quote, you can have it all, but not all at once. And I was really worried I was perpetuating that myth. Hey, I've got 3 kids, I've got a great job, I'm doing really well here, and look at me and having a nice time. And actually, it's really hard. It's really, really hard. There's compromises all the time. You know, I'm having to ditch an important meeting to be at an assembly, or vice versa. You know, these are decisions being made all the time. And I really struggled with it around the launch of Stylist. I had launched Stylist, and I had my first child within a year. Ooh. Yeah, not planned, game plan wise. And I was really worried. I thought I might have blown this opportunity at work, and I came back like a whirlwind because I wanted to prove myself. And it doesn't set a great precedent for other people, I think, because I think everyone just sees what they want to see. They don't see the tough bits. They don't see you crying at home. They don't see the massive things you're missing out on. So it feels really important to me to be honest about, actually, is it is very tough. It's all about compromises. Men have been compromising for years, but we just said they had it all. You know, it's like, also, men traditionally would not have been present at home or in their children's lives. And I think I shared a quote the other day, which is like, we're being asked to work like we don't have kids and parents like we don't have jobs. I mean, it's just mad, isn't it? So very keen to reset this conversation, actually.
Yeah, I think it was really important to kind of admit to that, because you just don't want anyone to think that, you're managing to do the meeting and the pickup. You're not.
No, simply one is being compromised for the other. And it does, I don't think it makes you a less good parent, and I don't think it makes you less good at your job. But it does mean is the reality you're not doing both at the same time. You're focusing on one at that time, and that is uncomfortable sometimes.
I don't know why I find the pickup thing really triggering, because I think that often, because I don't do it very often, and then I do go, and at first, the teachers didn't know who I was, and that feels, and it doesn't feel very good, because I want to be the mum that I wanted to be to them, but I'm not visible, and it's stupid, because I know that I'm parenting, I know that I'm raising them. But
no, but these are the dilemmas we're all struggling with, I think, and, you know, it's, I went to after school club, and they were like, who are you? I was like, oh, you're killing me. Hi, child, you're not allowed to come to me. They're like confused. Like, God, maybe I haven't done this before. You're right. But no, I mean, it is a constant challenge. And like, you know, every single day of the week I'll have a slightly different feeling or emotion about this. And, you know, sometimes I'm totally fine with it. Sometimes I find it really hard. I mean, I've said a few times, but when I didn't expect, when I went back to work after my first mat leave, to feel so guilty to my colleagues when I left to go home to pick up after nursery. So there's emotions that you haven't even considered that come into it, because they're so used to being available. And then obviously, likewise, I think as they're getting older and they're like, hang on, where are you going and what are you doing? And then you're like, yeah, you're right. You deserve to have my attention too. And I want to spend that time with you, but equally I want to go and do this. So how do I navigate that? I think, I mean, my big thing is trying to, but my daughter who's 6 has really got into the like, oh, you love work more than me chat, which I'm really desperately trying to go, no, work's awful. Like, I hate work. I just have to not set that perception, you know, kind of go, I want to be a good role model for work and opportunity, whilst also trying to make you feel good. I mean, it's like, I just don't hear my husband having this conversation, I'll be honest.
No, but also you can count on your kids to go straight
to the jugular.
Yeah, you said it.
Thank you.
All my deepest fears. of being, but you know, maybe this is the irony of it. They will teach us how to find the boundaries, to find the way to talk about it, because you've got to explain it to her fundamentally, haven't you?
And then you're like, actually, what do I want to say here? What do I think here? Yeah, I mean, they do force you to put words to the things that you're trying to block out sometimes.
Yeah, so. and if actually, that's my parameter, like, there's loads of work things that I feel like I have to do, and then it's always those ones where you're like, actually, really, am I doing it from purely my own gain? Which is okay sometimes, but you know,
yeah, there's balance, isn't there? It's back to balance and compromise. I mean, this is it, and that's it. I don't pretend to know or have advice in this space, and I think anyone in it is just navigating it and doing the best bloody job they can. But I think that's the candor that needs to be shared. Is no one's nailing this. It's just a very challenging situation, and we will probably all make compromises, and it will keep changing. It will keep changing as they change as well.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think in my early kid years, I was like trying to find the perfect answer. It changes with every work situation and with it, every child and their age.
Yeah, totally.
But it isn't easy. I'm also laughing because we are recording it exactly pick up.
I mean, I'm glad you noticed, because I hadn't. The guilt got
we're
you.
Not there. Two questions to end. Where can people find you?
I'm a relatively private person. I love being the ambassador of a brand. I love that. And I love speaking on behalf of stylists. I'm actually quite comfortable talking to you now. It's not that I have a problem with that, but I found that hasn't troubled me to having a social platform. However, I am there at Lisa Smazarski on all the platforms. The benefit of a tricky name is that I can own Lisa Smazarski everywhere.
That's true. You've got the good handle.
Yeah.
And then I always ask at the end of all podcasts, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be?
Oh my
God. What would you
God,
say?
God, yeah. It's got to be with this current government. I mean, I'm at my wit's end. I've got to be honest. I'm like... do you know what? This could start a really long round, and I won't get into it, but I... I'm so demoralised by how politics runs in this country. We are so regressive. We are dealing in a culture of sleaze. I'd like to go back and have a word with David Cameron, actually, and ask him why he bloody ran that referendum and passed the buck and caused this beginning of a total cascade of shit. But actually, I just am so disheartened that I'm bringing kids up in a world with so much dishonesty and bad behavior, full stop. I think that is a conversation I'd like to have really quite candidly.
I feel the same. Again, I'm very conscious of time, but do you ever weave politics into stylist, or is it a...
Yeah, we do definitely tackle politics. I mean, actually, up on our social media today, obviously we'll take up on Instagram today, there's a story about the Met Police actually, and how women don't report actually cases of, I guess, misogyny or abuse that they've experienced. So we'll deal with politics in that sense. We do speak to the leaders and to politicians on a regular basis. We've got good relationships with a few MPs who we work with as well. So it's part of the conversation. When we launched Stylist, we wanted it to be the equivalent of conversation with your friend, where you would talk about your job, you'd talk about politics, you might talk about the food or the wine that you're drinking, you might talk about what you're wearing to a wedding, then you might come back and talk about career again and a promotion that you're going for. It's that fully rounded experience. So yeah, I think politics, particularly in this day and age, have to be quite a loud part of that mix.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, that's exactly why the magazine is so great, because this is it. All of this stuff can sit together, can't it?
Yeah, I think so. We do try and give a balance, but I've not been very balanced, I realise. But
you're an individual person.
I'm an individual person and I don't work for the BBC. But it's the... You know, I think we will always try and give a balanced and kind of nuanced perspective when we tackle these things. Because, I spend a lot of time following people on Twitter I don't agree with, so I can really understand the whole conversation. So I think, again, that's really important. How do we have a rounded understanding? Because I'm very, very focused on the fact that we live in a black and white world, but most of it is grey. And there's no room for the grey conversation. And how do we open that up and have nuance and, you know, get into the fact that you might have your opinion changed if you can understand different perspectives. I think that's it. The danger of the polarisation means that we're not having those conversations. So again, that's what we'll try and do with Stylist.
Well, thank you so much. We really have rattled through quite a few things.
We've rattled through quite a few things, probably digressed quite significantly.
No, that's all right. I like a bit of digression. Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time.
It was lovely to chat to you. Thank you.
And that's another episode wrapped. Thank you so much for listening to Meet the Founder, part of But Why podcast. It's so easy to forget the humans behind the products that fill our shelves and phones. But I love being reminded that every brand began with a person having a great idea. These chats are about more than me being nosy, although that is a big part of it. It's about remembering the reality that success isn't linear and that being a founder doesn't take one shape. Thank you so much to my guests and thank you for listening. And just one more ask, if you could please leave us a review or shout about it on social media, it makes a huge difference to the number of listens we get. And last but not least, if you do want to get in touch, and I always love hearing from you, you can email me on butwhy@clemmytelford.com or find us at butwhypodcast on Instagram. Wishing you a very excellent day and catch you next time.